We are the Nonprofits. Hi, everybody. I'm your host, Jeff D. My producer is Russell Glasser.
Hello.
Our guests today are Linda Raymond.
Afternoon.
And Dennis LeBay.
Howdy.
Dennis, happy birthday.
Oh, thank you.
How old are you today, Dennis?
Well, I've been around the sun, I think, 47 times now.
47 entire times?
Yeah.
Cool. Today's opening music was Battle Without Honor or Humanity by Tomoyasu Hotai from the Kill Bill Volume 1 soundtrack. We are live March 13, 2004. Hello to everybody in the Atheist Network chat room. Thanks for stopping by. And on to business. Now, we were... our show airs every other week, but we didn't do one 2 weeks ago because why, Russell? What was our excuse?
You were at the Phantom of the Opera.
I was at the Phantom of the... That's right.
Damn it.
Phantom of the Opera. It was the last weekend that it was showing, and I'd promised my partner that we would go.
What?
So,
didn't you tell Russell?
No, I did, but like I got the tickets Friday morning. Reserved the tickets Friday morning.
No so time to assemble a...
Yeah.
An alternate...
Right. You thought about doing a show, didn't you?
Yeah, but I decided it was easier not to this time.
It's generally easier not to. Well, that's why we're here, folks, to do a fine show for you. If you encounter any instances of slurs, defamation, or discrimination against atheists or other non-believers in the U.S. media, write up all the info about it and email it to ombuds@atheism.org.
They must be swamped.
Yeah, I think they probably are. The Heart of the Beholder Film Project is still looking for contributions. In the latest email I got from them, I believe they said that they have now collected $500,000, which is a pretty hefty budget for an independent film.
That's nice.
But of course, the more they get, the better they can make that film. So, for information on how you can get involved, and possibly contribute and even make a little money off the investment when the film comes out, go to www.beholder.com. And, something else that happened, in the last couple of weeks is a bunch of us from the atheist community of Austin, a small bunch. Well, four.
Five.
Five?
Well, four in a group, and then Martin saw it separately.
Went to see The Passion of the Christ.
And, the Passion.
What'd you think of that?
Well, I'll tell you what the rest of the country thinks
of it. Did
he
bleed or what?
He bled. There's no doubt about that.
It was,
It was, you know, we thought we had this discussion going in about how, you know, maybe it's not really all that violent because, you know, Christians, they might be kind of sensitive, thinking, well, I didn't expect any violence in this movie. No.
Yeah. Mel Gibson, no. Not sensitive.
No. This is
not
a
sensitive.
Very, very bloody movie.
Yeah.
Although Ginny commented on, he's wearing a latex suit. What's the big deal?
We all know it was makeup, right? But still, yeah. I mean, of course, I've seen war movies with people being blown in half, right? So the only thing that was really that extreme about this one is, well, there he is in the bright sunlight in the courtyard with the Romans actually whipping on him.
Yeah, when they get blown in half,
you know,
it's just boom, and then you got some pieces, and they're dead.
Yeah, sure. Then they drag this out. But, after the actual whipping, during the whole, like, standing there in front of the crowd, and then dragging the cross to up the hill.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the dragging the cross up the hill part, the sense I got there was, gosh, that's heavy, right? Not, gosh, that's heavy, and, oh, by the way, 98% of my body is covered with little wounds that are bleeding. You know? I mean, after the actual whipping, the impact of the whipping was gone. So it wasn't for me, anyway, that much different from Well, except that the whipping took, like, what, 10 minutes, or however long they spent on it.
Just out of curiosity, after the whipping, did they show things like flies and bugs swarming onto the body while he was trudging uphill?
No, they didn't do that. But I mean,
didn't feel the need to be that disgusting.
They really emphasized how damn in pain he was while he was trudging uphill. I mean, you know, he drags himself up, right? He's like, and then the guy comes to help him on the cross, and like the guy tries to shoulder the cross, and like he can't carry it even though he's perfectly healthy, and Jesus is just barely dragging his ass up the hill.
Funny, the other healthy guys carrying the other crosses up the hill didn't seem to have any trouble.
Well, they gave Jesus the heavy one.
Okay, sure, because it's the big
this one's uranium.
And for the arrangement of the crosses on the hill, the biggest, heaviest one goes in the middle, and that's where Jesus was. He's the centerpiece.
I didn't see the movie, but I did go to the bookstore and take a glance at the nice coffee book.
Pictures from the film?
Pictures from the film, yes. It's got this wonderful cover picture of this incredibly magenta, bloody Jesus.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's about what it was. I mean, well, and you know, the point of doing it this way is to show you, yeah, this really hurt. You don't think he suffered for your sins, but boy, did he suffer for your sins.
No, is it to make us feel guilty?
But you know,
apparently.
But he succeeded in what he set out to do. Why should we feel guilty that he succeeded in what he set out to do?
You mean he meant to?
He meant to do all
what
this
it
stuff.
Is. Here's what it is, right?
Mission accomplished.
Christianity is based on this premise that if somebody does you a favor, without you asking them, right? Just out of the blue, they do something for you. You owe them for that.
Apparently, yeah, the Mafia works on that plot, too.
The what?
The Mafia. They work that way.
That's right.
So does the Yakuza.
Well, did your store get burned down today? No, that was us. Fork it over.
Here it's like, in the same way that Christianity fabricates a solution, you know, salvation, to the problem it fabricated, hell,
right?
Here it's will fabricate a sacrifice to fabricate some guilt.
Well,
it's like,
well, I think, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I say, by using the word sacrifice, you're already buying into the worst propaganda, which is that it was a sacrifice. I mean, you've got a being that has lived eternally without a beginning. He spends a few years down on Earth, and he's going to go back to ruling eternally the whole galaxy. And for 3 days, he went through the sort of pain that you would experience, comparatively speaking, if you put your hand on the stove burner. Big deal. It comes, it goes. And then the next day, you forget about it. After eternity, I guarantee he has forgotten about having his back ripped up.
Yeah, you know, I had my wisdom teeth pulled out last month, and that hurt for quite a while. And now it doesn't hurt anymore.
Thank you for forgiving me of my sins.
I did it for your sins.
So, pain for 3 days and then become master of the universe.
I didn't get that part. I feel ripped off.
But the deal of the century.
Okay. But okay, but back to this bogus rationale that you owe somebody for things that they did that you benefited from, that you didn't ask for, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right. And now, you can make a case for that when you're talking about, like, you know, a government, right? Where
or a soldier sacrificing his life.
If you didn't directly order him to go out and do that, I mean, there are some things that we can benefit from that others do that we should at least look at those and go, oh, boy, I'm glad somebody's doing that shit, right? That's fine. But say, in the, there's actually laws in the books, in the postal system. If you receive something in the mail without ordering it, you cannot be billed for it. That is illegal. Nobody can stick you with a fee for something you didn't ask for. Right?
That's right.
So I think that the whole point of making this tremendously huge, overblown stink about how painful it was for Jesus is to try to blast through that legal question, right?
Right.
And just go straight, as you said, to guilt, right?
Yeah.
Try to force people to respond because of how
purely emotionally.
But with a big emotional appeal about how painful it was for the guy to do this thing for you that you never asked for.
One way, it's a good sign because it shows they've already learned they can't appeal to the intellect. So you could consider this sort of a dying gas, a last hurrah going for the emotions because they've already given up.
No, it's like a two-sided attack. I mean, you know, there are different groups that are still trying to make Christianity appeal to you on your intellect, but they recognize that they're, you know, you also need the emotional side. Of course, the intellectual arguments are all bullshit.
Yeah. Now, you wrote a little review of this film already, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
And did you put that on the web?
I have it on the web.
Do you want to list your URL?
Yeah, well, actually, if you go to the nonprofit's homepage, atheist-community.org/radio radio.htm, which I have neglected to put in the chat room so far.
Huh.
By the way, spiffy new chat room.
Are we going to be able to copy and paste?
Yes, it's once again based on IRC, so I will begin posting chat logs to the website again.
Cool, like we used to.
Yes.
So those of you listening to this show after the fact on the Atheist Community of Austin website, www.atheist-community.org, can not only listen to this, to the audio on demand, but also read the...
But pretend you participated in the chat.
Yeah, by reading along with the chat and try to figure out
how
that
cool.
syncs up, which is sort of...
But also on the nonprofit's homepage, I have links to pages of stuff that you and I write. You have your What Worries Jeff D page, which I link to, and I now have my page full of miscellaneous stuff. Movie reviews, game reviews, it's a work in progress. Anyway, you can go there and click on my passion link.
And in that review, you said there's one overriding emotion in this film, and that emotion is?
Ouch. It really hurts. And, you know, another thing I mentioned in my review is that they tried really hard to be, like, letter perfect to the parts of the Bible that there actually are in there. I mean, you know, it's like they went down a little checklist. It's sort of like what people say about the Harry Potter movies, which is, you know, oh, they're just slavishly following the original text. Well, you know, they do their best. They're like, you know, they focus a whole lot on the 30 pieces of silver that Judas gets.
How did Judas die in the movie?
Because that's an anchor point.
Interestingly, in the Judas story, there's two different versions of the Bible.
Oh, right.
Which do they
pick? One is he's running across the field and he falls down and explodes.
No, he hangs himself and then he falls in his...
He falls off a cliff or something.
In one, he falls off a cliff and bursts.
No, in this one, he just hangs himself.
Uh-huh. Near this short cliff where there's this rotted carcass of a donkey or something that looks like it sort of burst open.
Really? I did not notice that.
I think that... You didn't notice that donkey?
They're trying to cover all the bases, huh?
Wow.
Wow.
Or I forgot
it was,
about it.
It was a big, big, big part of that scene.
Okay.
Maybe I have just watched too many action-adventure films, but... The whole ouch thing was not really happening for me. I mean, apart from the first few slashes of the whip, when they were starting the effects of him getting, special effects of him getting all cut up, I mean, that made me wince.
Wince-worthy, yes.
But after that, it's like, okay, so now there he is.
And they're still hitting him.
He got these little red lines all over him, but I didn't get any sense that he was hurting from them.
The
crown of thorns on. Yeah, he's a robot.
I know.
Indiana Jones, right?
Yeah.
Did Jesus' girlfriend flip over the mirror and nail him under the chin? No. So, but that's not really what I got from it. For me, the big overriding message that was like screaming down from me at me from the screen the entire time was desperation.
Desperation.
It just seemed like an extremely desperate attempt to get people to take this
The movie was desperate.
The making of the film.
It's as
like,
subtle as a sledgehammer.
People don't believe this thing I believe anymore. Please, please, please believe. Please.
The thing about being as perfectly accurate to the text as possible is, if you actually read the Bible, there's not all that much text.
And it's dull.
It is.
What is there is dull.
Oh, wow, yeah, way dull.
I mean, you know, there's like 5 pages per gospel, and most of it retreads the same material. So, you know, given the rule that a page of text is worth a minute of screen time, this should have been a 5-minute movie. I mean, for instance, it's actually similar to something that I got, something that I noticed when I was trying to read. I have not read the entire Lord of the Rings, but after the first movie, I flipped through and looked for some of the good bits.
Yeah.
And I noticed that the part with the Balrog that I thought was really cool lasted like half a page.
Yeah.
Same deal here. I mean, you read the text and it says, "And they scourged him." Right. And that's the whole thing.
Yep. But Gibson did, to
that a miracle,
to his credit, right? He did expand on the story in several ways.
Quite a bit.
What? What?
Yes, he did. He did do that.
But I mean, it wasn't just like, you know, okay, we got 5 minutes worth of pages, so we're gonna do the whole thing in slow-mo, so it'll take 2 hours. No. It's padded. There's scenes that are not in the Bible, and we'll get into some of those in a minute. But also, one of the things that struck me about the film is that in the course of all this padding that he did, there was no real new take on anything. It was very much just exactly and only what you'd expect, right? It's not like, you know, somebody redoes some famous, film. And they pick some new angle on it and they change it. And that's what pisses most people off, right? But at least they try. They try to bring something new to the material.
Well, I was given to understand there was like an androgynous Satan wandering around in the crowd and little devil midgets.
But we'll get into those things in a minute.
Okay, right? I think those are changes.
But there were some additions, but they didn't really... There's no new angle, which of course I guess you'd expect, right? But you're not allowed to change the angle of the story.
Well,
if you do, then you make a film like The Last Temptation of Christ, it pisses everybody off.
But does the Bible say anything about Satan being there guiding the hands of the Jews or anything like that?
I don't know.
Because that would be his...
It depends on which gospel.
Really,
and I didn't do... I got to be honest with you, I did not sit down and reread the Gospels. Sit down and reread The Lord of the Rings. When I heard that film was coming out,
okay,
sat down, three books, read the
thing
and
about
the Silmarillion and The Hobbit.
I'm going to be able to read The Silmarillion.
In series, in order to be prepared for the films.
The thing about the Gospels.
Why I didn't like them that much.
The earlier books, Mark and Luke, are not so much anti-Semitic. But as time went on, and you know, we're talking like 70 years later when John and Matthew got written, it was becoming increasingly clear that the new Christian cult was saying, you know, hey, this guy's supposed to be king of the Jews, and the Jews are saying, what the fuck? We don't care about this guy.
We didn't vote for him.
So there is a more concerted effort that you can see visibly rearing its head in Matthew and John, where the Jews actually, you know, say stuff that makes it obvious that they're trying to be discredited. Like in Matthew, what's that guy's name? Pontius Pilate says, I don't really want to crucify this guy. Are you sure I need to? And they say, yes, crucify him and let his blood be on our heads and the heads of our children. So, you know.
Which, I've heard that line. Like, the first part of that is in the film. Not the second part.
No.
Not what I hear.
The whole line is in the film. It's just not translated.
It's not all translated. Wow, I didn't know that.
He took out the subtitles under pressure from Jewish groups, but he did not take out the line.
Wow.
Yeah, I heard
and
from
I've got a link to that in my review.
Yeah, and by the way, I'm pretty much with those people that say the film is anti-Semitic. I don't think it's necessarily because Mel Gibson himself is anti-Semitic, but I do think it's because that's what's in the material he was
You realize you're therefore contradicting Ann Coulter. She says,
gee, what a
oh,
she says it's almost a paragon of Jew-loving, or however she, I forget what she said, but there's no
paragon of Jew-loving.
That's paraphrasing. She wrote an entire column about how all these stupid liberals are overreacting, I guess, activist moving hours.
One thing that was pointed out to me that I didn't notice at the time I was watching was that this androgynous Satan that we mentioned,
yeah,
when he/she appears, and it is actually played by a she. It is actually played by a woman. I looked it up.
Oh, it is. Okay.
Yes. But when it appears,
which, by the way, is kind of creepy. In the Bible, yes. Satan is clearly a guy.
Yeah,
Satan's
he's
a
referred
guy.
To as he.
Right. Satan's a guy in the Bible.
Well,
why? Did they find it, it? This is not only anti-Semitic, but anti-female.
I don't know if it, I mean, it's clear that they tried to make this woman look as androgynous as possible, don't
but
you think?
But why make it androgynous when their Bible clearly says it's a guy? It's a guy, it's a guy, it's a guy.
Well, I was given to understand.
Why go that way at all unless your point is to extend that blanket condemnation over women as well.
Just to make them look creepy.
Well, not only that, I was given to understand that not only Satan, but somebody else, was it Barnabas or whoever the other guy was, Barabbas?
Caiaphas.
There's some other people who come out as either effeminate or androgynous because the church automatically kind of condemns them. It's just a way of heaping on, you know, not just women, but just anybody who's not the super macho man.
Yes, I absolutely agree. And by the way, Dennis, you know, in response to what you just said, right? If they're making him androgynous in order to make him creepy, what does it say when the method they choose to make Satan creepy is to make him androgynous? What is it that creeps out Mel Gibson?
Good point. Well, the thing that was pointed out to me, getting back to the anti-Semitism angle, that I hadn't thought about was the fact that there is a scene where Satan appears, and he's flitting in and out of the Jewish crowd that's cheering on his death.
Oh yeah,
basically.
Yeah.
And popping in as if he were one of the faces.
Yeah.
You know, so that's another.
A friend of mine who saw the film, what he got out of that scene is that Satan was in the crowd, like working his mojo on the Roman torturers to make them torture more.
Okay.
I just did not get that. He didn't, I mean, there was no interaction between
him. I don't know, I think of it more as a part of...
He was there gloating on Jesus.
Yeah.
And that's what he was doing, period.
Well, but also, I'm thinking he's more, you know, he's one of the Jews. He's working from within the Jewish people.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know about that. I thought it was plenty that, you know, the entire crucifixion thing is driven by the leaders of the Jewish temple.
If you look at the Roman guys, your hero is
chosen by the leaders of that religion for torture and murder, right? They decided it. They drive the entire story. Duh. Yeah, they're the guys that at fault. There's no way around that.
Just out of curiosity, was the centurions very manly men? I was just wondering, how did he cast them?
Yeah, they were kind of manly men.
Oh yeah,
but. Oh yeah. I mean, what?
Not that I was paying attention. Not that there's anything wrong with that.
But the other thing is, and this is another thing that I gathered from the film is that apart from Satan himself, all other bad guys in the film were buffoons.
Mm, I've heard that.
I mean, it's like it's as if the statement of the film is the only real evil is Satan, and anybody that does what Satan likes is just silly.
Right.
We're just silly. Look at us. Look, we're gonna get Jesus some more. Isn't that silly? I mean, and really, I mean, it constantly there is the who's the king? Herod, right? Silly. He's silly. Look, you're bringing me a Jesus. Look at, he's just, I don't like him. Take him away. Herod's just silly.
And didn't somebody do like a little end zone dance?
Huh?
At some point?
I don't recall that, no. But I thought that was a pretty, naive and simplistic view of morality. Right there.
Now, obviously, what needs to be done is we need to do a what-if version.
Uh-huh.
What if they hadn't demanded his crucifixion and the devil hadn't been there egging on the crowd or doing whatever they're doing and all this stuff. And basically Jesus just stood around going, okay, well, nothing's happening, and went on with his life.
Well, then the movie would be The Last Temptation.
Well, then no one would, no one would have their salvation.
Yeah. Right. But it was very strange. There's other weird things about it. There's this scene. In fact, okay, there's three lessons I took away from.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
We're down to three.
The Passion of the Christ. I'm down to three. The fourth one was the thing
five.
About evil's buffoonery. No, I didn't.
Yes, you did.
Okay. Did I have five?
You did.
I'm pretty sure.
Remind me of whatever the other one is when I'm done with you. The first thing was the buffoonery thing. But yeah, there's Satan. Satan's not a buffoon. Satan is a
creepazoid.
Woman dressed as a man. Well,
cross-dressing deity, right.
Cross-dressing. That's clearly evil. But the other thing, that the film taught me was midgets equals evil. Because there were demons in this film, besides Satan, twice, in two different scenes. Actually three, but I can't really vouch for the third one. The first instance was the first time the demons came for Judas.
For Judas, yeah.
And like lunged for him under this bridge and he ran away. I couldn't really make out what those were. And the other two instances, the demons were portrayed by actual little people.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
People who are midgets.
Yeah, there was Satan holding the little kid.
Right, the little kid being carried around, little evil baby, I guess the Antichrist
baby. Yeah, like
baby
a little mini-me Satan.
Right, that was a midget. And then the kids that were making fun of Judas... when he was, like, feeling all down.
And boy, was that weird. It was almost like he was trying to make an excuse for the whole 42 bears thing, or 42 children being eaten by bears.
Just a second.
Like,
let's get back to
that. Boy, these kids really deserve to be eaten by bears right now.
I don't know why it was. Mel Gibson did not think that it would be appropriate to have, you know, full-sized, full-grown demons. Could have, right? Why not? In any of these scenes, that demons could have been... Except for the baby, right? But then the baby could have been some kind of weird creature without it being a midget playing the baby. So, midgets equals evil.
It sort of comes back to this androgynous thing. Anybody who's not the perfect physical specimen, you know, is somehow damned in the sight of God or something.
And also, babies are evil, according to Christianity. Right?
Babies are.
We're all born evil.
Ah, that's correct.
So
that's
babies
true.
Too. So maybe that's where he was coming from.
They're good for dashing against rocks.
That was pretty sick. Second thing is, you can, according to this film, and I guess according to the story it's based on, you can laugh at Jesus, you can throw stones at him, you can kick him, you can take away his stuff, you can lead him off in handcuffs, you can lock him in a cell, bring him out, whip him, jeer at him, flay the flesh from his bones. All this stuff, right? He won't lift a finger against you. But once he's up on the cross and he says, I'm about to go to heaven, if you're the guy in the cross next to him, don't laugh at him. Because if you do, crows will come down and peck out your eyeballs. This whole movie goes by without any retribution at all. Until suddenly, on the cross, this one guy... doesn't take it seriously, crows come down and peck out his eyes.
So they're anti-sense of humor, too.
Yeah, was he the first person in the movie to actually have a good belly laugh? Like, did anybody else get away with laughing?
No, although Barabbas got away with acting extremely silly, which I actually thought was a slightly good bit in the movie. You know, Barabbas?
Oh, yeah, right.
The guy,
right. The guy they let go instead of Jesus.
Yeah, you know, like in Life of Brian, where they're all going, Willy Swadger! I shall Willy Swadger! No, just one guy in the Bible, it was Barabbas, and they all go, we want you to free Barabbas, and he comes down and postures, and he's like, oh, yeah, does a little
he's
victory
a
dance.
Most evil guy, right? This is a character who is identified as a mass murderer. Comes dancing down the stairs like, whoa, look at me, I got up because this idiot decided to take my place.
He does like a little touchdown dance. It's pretty funny.
That's probably your thing. So that was extremely strange. That, you know, anytime that people the Christians talk about this film and say, well, it just proves that Jesus just took it, right? He could have used his powers any time to get away or defend himself. What about that time up on the cross where the crows come down and pick out the other cross victim's eyeballs? What about that? And then finally, what this movie taught me was that the Christian God is infinitely powerful as long as he's got his mommy around to help him through the rough spots. Because I lost track of how many times Jesus was falling down, passing out, about to give up, and then he sees Mother Mary in the crowd and flashes back to some scene from his childhood. Somehow that rouses him, and off he goes. Now, but you know, if what was really going on is this is a cosmic entity who is allowing this to happen to him, right, and not fighting back because there's this weird mystical formula he's got to complete in order to do his forgiveness thing, right, yeah. If that's what it was, then all that falling down and keeling over and nearly passing out stuff was a sham,
right?
That was all an act, because he didn't have to do that. He's choosing to go ahead and behave that way because that's what was necessary in order to get his point across, right? But in the film, it's like, shit, man, he's really on the ropes. He's really about to give up. But Mary pulled him through.
Thank goodness for Mary.
And speaking of flashbacks to Jesus' childhood.
Yeah.
Another thing that Gibson added, which doesn't really affect the story at all, right? But just some weird thing he stuck in that I cannot understand. There's this flashback to Jesus as a young carpenter, still living with his mom, but a grown man. Jesus has invented a table. Like, apparently, back in Jesus' days, all tables were, like, you know, knee-high. And he invented a tall table. And he says, come, mother, let me show you this thing that I have made. And she goes out, and she, like, looks underneath it, and she puts her hand on it and says, Jesus, it's very, very tall. Do you expect people to eat standing up? And he says, no, mother, I expect them to sit like this. And he crouches down on the air as if he's, like, miming sitting in a chair, right? And she looks over and sees how he's hanging his butt, and then she goes and adopts the same posture, right? And then she says, huh, it'll never catch on. You know?
Boy, that Jesus, what a visionary.
I'm not kidding you, folks.
I can't even attach that to a parable of any kind.
It's not in the Bible. I don't know what the hell Gibson was trying to say.
Jesus was a very forward-thinking carpenter. Yeah, he was like the Leonardo da Vinci of backwater carpenters.
Oh, yeah. No,
or maybe he's in a Roman dining room.
He had a problem with proportions.
That was intentional. Yeah, and I forgot. Also in that scene, Jesus says that next he's going to make the tall chairs to go with the tall table.
Oh, God.
But I kept thinking, look, this is the guy who inspired the entire Old Testament, that's just chock full of rules about how people are supposed to conduct their lives. What they're supposed to wear, what they're supposed to eat, how they're supposed to marry, everything, right? If he had wanted his people sitting in tall chairs at tall tables, why wasn't it in the Old Testament? Why did he wait until he incarnated as a human being and then, you know, living with his mom, suddenly then, out of the blue, go, you know, I think it would be best if my flock sat with their butts higher off the ground.
That was the last chapter of Leviticus.
It's just nuts.
Well, maybe it was one of the last chapters of Leviticus, one dealing with household furnishings.
So,
you can't make your chairs out of two kinds of fabric.
Biblical feng shui.
I don't know.
They expurged that chapter because it covered bidets and toilets, and they thought that was inappropriate for the book.
Well, spirit in the chat room. Wow. Both God and Satan are here, and they seem to be arguing over the movie.
Oh.
Satan, go to hell.
Well...
time.
So that's the kind of stuff that Gibson added to the film. These weird off-the-wall scene of Jesus, the, you know, forward-thinking, inventive carpenter.
Wouldn't you love to see the outtakes? Maybe there was a scene that explained that.
Yeah. No, I would totally love to see, like, you know, one of the Romans pounce on Jesus' hand accidentally, and he's like, oh, shit! And then they all laugh and go, let's do that again. I would like to see the outtakes of that movie.
The tall table subplot.
Maybe they'll include those on the DVD.
And there's only one other kind of thing that Gibson added to that story.
What's that?
He came up with even yet still more creative ways to torture Jesus. Right?
Yep.
In the Bible, there's one sentence, right? It says, and they flogged him. Right? Well, in the movie, it's 10 minutes long. And when they're done flaying the flesh off his backside, they uncuff him from the block and flop him down on his back on the ground and proceed to do his front. That's the kind of stuff, that's the other kind of stuff that Gibson added to the film. It's like, you know, I can improve on this story.
Call in some writers to punch it up a little bit.
I'm surprised he didn't add, like, you know, breaking all of his fingers. And yay, verily, after he was up on the cross, a centurion came along with a ladder and a hammer and went up and broke all his fingers.
Well, you know, there's only so much time.
They hung him from his arms from the cross because his feet were embedded in concrete. Yes.
And they did that, too. Oh, man. There's this, when they...
Embedded him
they
in concrete?
There's an upside-down thing. They nail the nails through his hands, which, by the way, word has it that Mel Gibson appears in that film.
Yes.
His hands appear in the film. He's the guy putting the nails through Jesus' palms, which is a whole new realm of creepy. But then, right, we're all familiar with that, right? They nail him to the thing, then they prop it up, and there he is. Well, in this... they nail the things into his hands, and then they pick up the cross, and they turn it over.
For so no apparent reason, right?
No, a reason becomes apparent later. He's dangling there by his nails, so that they can come in with hammers and, like, duke, 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 tip the ends of the nails over flush with the wood on the other side. Apparently, because otherwise, you know, they get so many crucifixion victims who just grab hold of those nails and yank them out of the logs.
Giving praise to Crom at the meanwhile.
Wow.
Well, is that right?
Well, they take pride in their work. That's good.
That's the kind of shit. And it's like, but that scene, the whole turn and the crossover thing is like, it takes, 3 minutes to get through it. It's like, close up on Jesus' face. Close on Jesus. The beast of the beast. Trips over and like, burr, he's hanging there. And dripping blood on the ground and stuff. I mean, it's...
Yeah, there's a river coming out of his hands at that point. Oh, and let me share with you a piece of nauseating trivia that I heard.
Yeah?
According to Mel Gibson in an interview, he did not appear anywhere in this film except one place.
We just did that. Oh. You weren't listening.
Damn it! That's what I get for trying to pay attention to a new chat room.
Yeah.
Damn well, you, God and Satan.
To Russell's credit, he's the guy I got this story from.
Right.
About the thing. So, that's the Passion over the Christ. Really, not much of a movie. I mean, it's just... they take 2 hours to show, you know, this thing.
Yeah, that's been described as a snuff film, yeah.
Well, it's not the kind of thing where you get, like, character development.
Well, he does become, like, you know, he just, like, rise from the dead and stuff.
Yeah, well, there's like...
It's a development.
There's, like, what is it, a 10-second shot at the end, suddenly he's all better.
And there's 10 seconds at the beginning where he says... Oh, I'm not sure I want to do this.
Well, the character development arc can more be likened to blood loss, you know.
Well, maybe that's where the table is. That was from the long-lost arc of the character development. You get to see his more human side.
The character development arc of the Covenant.
Yes.
All right. So anyway,
wow.
Can't recommend this film, really. I'd say on a 1 to 5 star scale, I'd give it a 2 for trying with the effects. That's about
it. Oh, wait.
It.
That's what I gave it. Never 2? Mind.
Okay.
Yes.
Was yours on a 1 to 5?
1 to 5.
I don't know. Okay. You know, really, it just struck me as a big propaganda ploy to hammer home, as it were, the message that Jesus went through a lot of pain, which, you know, while I can sympathize with somebody going through a lot of pain, the whole thing about four people's sins is covered in, again, the first 2 minutes of the film, where Satan says, nobody could go through all the pain it will take to save mankind from their sins. It's like it's just like sort of a challenge to Jesus. Like, you know that you can't do it.
Another bet.
But again, I mean, there's no effort spent establishing things like, that there are such things as sins or souls or any of that crap, right? It's all based on the premise.
Oh, that's a given.
Well, so, yeah, I mean, this is not an attempt. This is not necessarily a direct conversion attempt.
That's
this
a preaching
is more
to the choir
of a
event.
Preaching to the choir movie. Although, yeah. You know, obviously they hope that, and I've heard all these Christian radio personalities say, oh yeah, take all your unbelieving friends, and then they'll be so confused at the end of it, they'll want to know, tell me more about this Bible that you speak of. I do not understand all these scenes.
Jeez.
Does anybody know anybody who has said, and this goes up to the chat room as well, does anybody know anybody who saw that film and then said, yeah, you know, I wasn't a Christian before, but now, gosh darn it, I am?
Well, anybody? I'm sure if you listen to said radio personalities, they will give you evidence by anecdote.
Okay. Well, I'm asking for, you know, trustworthy people.
Yeah. Anyway, I mean, as far as recommending the movie, I like to see that kind of, I mean, I like to experience that kind of thing firsthand just so I can know what I'm talking about. A whole, I mean, for the same reason that I bother to listen to these crappy Christian radio shows.
And that's
I want to get their
here
arguments
for,
from
we're
their
here
own
to
work.
Suffer through shit like this so that we can bring you the straight story. So you don't
so you're
have
saving
to.
Them. Yeah. You're making the sacrifice
right.
to save
that's
your
right.
listeners.
This is
that's
the sacrifice
right. I was literally dripping blood from holes in my palms that I gnawed through. My hands as I was watching this piece of crap.
So now those people owe you.
No, they don't.
Okay. Well,
wait. I have more to say. Sorry, I have more to say about this horrible thing.
Okay.
I get the message, right? That the whole idea that this is this cosmic entity that went down and willingly submitted to having this done to it for as part of some mystic ritual to save us all from our sins. You know, setting aside the whole question of whether there is such a thing as sin or any place that we're going to, bad that we're going to go that we have to be saved from or any of that nonsense. I'm sorry. I'm just not impressed by people who submit to unjust punishment. If we're simply talking about, you know, the claim here is that this is a god. And they're saying, well, you know, yeah, he could have used his superpowers to save himself, but he chose not to. Well, that's like saying, I've got superpowers. You know, I could be president of the United States right now if I wanted to. Just snap my little fingers, and I could be president. But I'm not, because I choose to refrain. You know, that proves nothing. You know how they could have proved to me in this story that this was a god? If the whips with the little sharp pieces of glass in them bounced harmlessly off his back, and he looked back over his shoulder with a grin and said, "You guys just about done?" you know, that would have convinced me that we're talking about a being that's not just a guy who's deluded.
Right. It also would have made better Hollywood. Yeah.
Hell yeah! Remember, you know, I think this movie was missing the Matrix ending. Remember, at the end of the Matrix, Neo is in the phone booth, and he phones up the computer and says, we're gonna take you down and stuff, blah, 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 at the beginning of that. And then he flies off into the sky like Superman. Right?
Yeah.
Well.
That was pretty cool, yeah.
Well, he could do that because he's in a computer simulation where he has control of the rules of physics and stuff.
Okay. But God exists outside of time. Same thing.
Right. Could have done the same shit. At the end of the movie, we get I've had a lot of people ask me if they show the actual rising from the dead. Yeah, but just this one moment of you're inside the tomb and there is his shroud and it sort of deflates because there's nobody in there. And then Jesus kind of comes onto the screen, you know, in profile from the left.
Yeah, with a nice little light on him,
and all of his wounds are gone, and he sort of gives this little Mona Lisa kind of, you know, mysterious smile.
Well, he looks wistful.
And walks out of the frame, right? Ha ha, he's risen from the dead. I want to see him go up into the sky over Jerusalem with his robes trailing behind him, right? An aura of crackling energy. I'd believe that was some kind of supernatural entity.
You know, he could at least walk through the wall or something like the X-Men.
Something.
Well, had you heard about the parody Saturday Night Live's already put out?
No.
Actually, I think Keith was mentioning this, or maybe it was Bill at the coffee shop, but they went ahead and they had fun with the idea of Benny Hinn and the Benny Hill show, and they'd have Christ up there, and then also they started playing the music. Yeah, and then he jumped off the cross with it on his back, and he's running around like he's playing Airplane. And apparently there are women in bikinis chasing after him, and they disappear off the screen, and they come back, and he's chasing them. I would have loved to see that very much.
Wow. All right. Okay. So Russell, how's this film doing?
It's doing pretty well.
Yeah, it is. Unfortunately.
Not surprisingly.
Making a lot of money. I'm just glad that is going to, you know, Mel and his production company personally and not any churches.
Yeah, and when I remember a comment Martin made, which is, you know, I don't ever want to hear Mel Gibson again talk about how persecuted he's been.
Right.
Folks, $228.1 million as of like 2 days ago. As moviegoers continue to render unto Mel Gibson the things that are Gibson's. The directors of the Passion of the Christ should once again reign as the King of Kings atop, oh boy, they're just dripping with this stuff, atop the box office mountain, despite the arrival of three new films. New market films' R-rated Passion Play fell just 36% in its second weekend, pulling in another $53.2 million to bring its 12-day gross to $213.9 million. As of Wednesday, Passion's purse had grown to $228.1 million, and it ranked number 39 among all-time domestic box office grossers. If its momentum holds this weekend, a 35-40% decline would see the film pick up another $32 million to $36 million. That, in turn, will boost its cumulative grosses to the $265 million range, kicking it up the all-time chart by at least 15 notches. It will surpass, in the process, it will surpass IFC's 2002 My Big Fat Greek Wedding, which has held the record as the most successful independent film ever with its $241.4 million tally. So.
My Big Fat Aramaic Execution.
Yeah. Of course, you know, the thing about this is with a successful, well, not Mel Gibson.
He has hinted that he'll make more films from the Bible.
Yeah, The Passion 2.
Well, what I want to know is who gets to do the book adaptation.
No, but even aside from Mel Gibson, you know how it is in Hollywood. I mean, if a movie is that successful, remember when, like, you know, we had a whole summer filled with natural disaster films.
Sure. And there was the year of the underwater films.
Right.
And then the asteroid impacts.
The asteroid
impacts.
Yep.
Yeah, they come in waves. So sit down and
let's hope not.
I've already seen part of the first wave when I saw on ABC the week after The Passion. Judas. They were advertising something called Judas, which we didn't watch. But you know, I noticed in passing that Jesus spoke in a lot of colloquialisms in that. You know, he was like, you know, we're not going to do it that way, or, you know, that's how he talked.
Don't go there, Judas.
Gosh.
So there's more coming.
Of course, you can have fun thinking of good titles for the sequels. I don't know, just like, Christ, I'm angry. great. Coming
this
back for more.
Well, if you wanted to do a sequel rather than a prequel, you're going to have to go to either Paul or the Well, you know, there's the Left Behind series. They've already got that market covered.
Yeah.
Except they suck.
Steve Martin. Everybody remember Steve Martin, comedian?
Oh, yeah.
Right? Arrow through the head.
Yeah.
That guy. Has launched a biting satirical attack on Mel Gibson, mocking The Passion of the Christ as money-making show business and suggesting it should have been called Lethal Passion. While Mr. Gibson, who made the film with his own money, claims that his intention was to produce a profound statement of his religious beliefs, Mr. Martin, influenced perhaps by the film's ticket sales, appears to disagree. In Martin's column, Stan, a fictitious studio boss, sends Mr. Gibson studio script notes on The Passion, effusing excitedly at the commercial and dramatic prospects for the script he has just been sent, but suggesting some changes to widen its appeal. Jesus is such a likable character, Mr. Martin's fictional studio boss enthuses, because he can't seem to catch a break, and everyone can identify with that. But there's a flaw that, he suggests, audiences will not understand. Why did Jesus not use his superpowers to save himself? An explanation is in order. Cut away to two spectators, have one pose the question, and the second reply, he can only use his superpowers to save others. On the lengthy and gruesome scenes of Jesus being whipped, which have forced many cinemagoers to turn their heads, Stan remarks briefly, "Love the flaying." In a move that reflects Hollywood's practice of including a recognizable brand on screen in return for sponsorship from the manufacturer, Stan suggests some product placement. Is there some place where Jesus could be using an iBook? He asks. Think about it. Maybe we start a shot in heaven with Jesus thoughtfully closing the laptop. A spokesman for Icon Productions, Mr. Gibson's production company, refused to comment on Mr. Martin's column. Others have made similar criticisms, less entertainingly, however, as the debate over the film continues to engulf America. Frank Rich, the senior critic for the New York Times, who earned Mr. Gibson's enmity by voicing concerns over anti-Semitism while The Passion was in production, wrote last week that the jury was still out on the film. What can be said without qualification is that the marketing of this film remains a masterpiece of ugliness typical for our cultural moment when hucksters wield holier-than-thou piety as a club for their own profit, he wrote.
Yeah.
Mr. Gibson said in an interview that he would like Mr. Rich's guts on a stick. That's a quote. Quote,
well, there's
guts
that Christian,
on a stick, unquote.
Well, there's that Christian love.
Entertainment Weekly magazine surveyed the box office receipts of the film and quoted a producer as saying that if he were Mr. Gibson, he would instead give Frank Rich 10% of his profits. As the controversy rages, the money pours in.
That's right.
By the way, before I forget, since you mentioned like product placement in the movie,
yeah.
There is right now...
Well, there is product placement. Duh. It's a yeah. religion.
Right now on somethingawful.com.
Yes, I've seen some of those.
What?
If you go to somethingawful.com right now and look at their Photoshop feature where they ask readers to submit like Photoshop's things based on a theme, there is a whole bunch of pictures from the movie of commercialism. My favorite example was they have Jesus hanging there from the cross, and it says, "Not going anywhere for a while? Try a Snickers bar." But, you know, they Photoshop things into his hands.
Awesome. Oh, boy.
Would that be the one where they show the Romans wearing Nikes or something?
Yeah, that's the one.
Yes. Just do it.
Now, when we were in the film... we were watching the film. There was a couple sitting next to me, and the young lady was like wincing and going like that, you know, every time there was violence directed at Jesus. And you know, we've heard a lot about that kind of thing. I was happy to note that at the end of the film, there was no applause.
They probably thought it would be sacrilegious.
Yay!
He's been killed.
He's just risen from the dead. The movie does not end with him dying. It ends with him, whoa, and he, you know, has a little mysterious smile, and he walks off camera. Like,
it really was not an upper of a movie. I think even if you're religious, the focus was not.
I'm telling you, they needed the Matrix ending.
Yeah.
Now there's Rising from the Dead, like 600
miles. Got it up.
Shooting through the air, leaving a vapor trail with his hair blown back. And then, like, Satan could fly up there, too, and they could, like, fly around each other and zip in and, you know, punch each other in the face.
Mister of Nazareth, I've been waiting for Jesus you.
Jesus can rip it in half and throw him to the ground.
Surprise.
Well,
to
maybe
see me?
And say you could have some Nazarite or something, the version of kryptonite that, you know, makes him weak.
Nazarite.
Maybe that's what the cross was. That's what the cross was made of. That's why he couldn't carry it.
See, they could have made it somebody I could look up to.
They could have put him with those superpowers. He would have been in a position to exact vengeance on the guys who did all this stuff to him.
That's right.
And then he could say, "No, I forgive you," and it would actually mean something because he'd be in a position to exact vengeance.
He burst into the wall of the temple. There'd be this Jesus-shaped hole in the wall, striding in and billowing smoke, and they all cower in the corner. It's Jesus.
We're gonna get it now.
And then he says, "You are very naughty. Don't do that again." But.
The Romans cowering. Oh, Christ, he's angry!
But no,
they would all fall on their knees and say, "Do you forgive us, Lord?" And then it's, you know, a nice little Jack Chick type.
There's
ending.
A guy, as the story is, there's a guy nailed up to the cross and stuff, you know, and he can't do anything to anybody.
Yeah.
But he goes, "Well, I forgive you all. Yeah, that's it. I forgive you."
What else are you going to do, pee on him?
I guess you figured "I forgive you" would sound better than "Oh, you're really gonna get it." You know,
oh, break your legs off.
Flesh
When I get down from here, I could beat you up, but I choose not to. Yeah, that's it.
I'm just winded. Wait till I get my second wind back.
Also, I have the power to keep elephants away.
Yes.
But Jesus, there aren't any elephants around.
You
see how good that works. Yeah. Okay. Now, there's some stories of the effects that this film is having on young, impressionable young children.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, wasn't there a story where somebody had a heart attack?
Yes,
I heard that.
She did. It was fatal. She had a heart attack. I think it was in Kansas City, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And she was DOA when they got to the hospital.
Right. Do we know what part of the film she died during?
I hear it was the actual crucifixion bit, but that part I'm not sure of.
So was that a segue that I should start some news stories here?
Yeah, it was.
Okay. Well,
have correctly discerned your hint that you should go on with that story that you got for me.
From Ananova.com, a UK news site, pupils offered counseling over Passion of the Christ. Pupils at a U.S. school have been offered counseling after a teacher showed them clips of Mel Gibson's film, The Passion of the Christ.
You're talking about students here, right?
Yes.
Not the eyeballs of the guy that got poked out by the
crow. Not the one that got pecked out by the crow, no. Officials at Malcolm X Elementary School, boy, that should also give you a chip on your shoulder, in the Congress Park area of Washington, D.C., say teacher Ronald Anthony has been given leave pending an investigation. Kuthera Ransom 11 walked out of the lesson for sixth graders after watching 15 minutes of the film. She said, "I saw Jesus getting beaten. Needles were going in his arms. It was scary the way they was beating him. It made me feel really bad. Terrible." About 20 pupils were shown the film. School officials say they're looking at how Mr. Anthony managed to get a hold of the copy of the film, which hasn't been released on video or DVD. Typical Christian here. Principal Vaughn C. Kimbrough says students disturbed by the images will be offered counseling. It's thought the pupils were shown 60 to 90 minutes of the two-hour film.
That would just cover the beating parts, right?
Yeah.
Where's this counseling going to come from? Because I have a suspicion.
Let's hope it's not.
Well, I got the impression from another article that it was just your typical school counselors. You know, they have grief counselors and whatnot
right.
and send
let's
them
hope.
In.
But,
you think it might be the local Baptist?
It could be. You never know.
Little girl, you
what
didn't feel awful
is
enough.
What the point of showing that to little children other than to scare
well,
the fucking
one thing
shit
I pointed out
so
on...
That you can, so that then you can entice them into your religion.
Well, one thing I was interested in is the thing that the kid said. I saw Jesus getting beaten, and I feel really bad and terrible about that. Now, the Christian would say, you know, it's good she feels bad because that shows her what a horrible sinner she is.
Right.
Whereas we say it's good that she feels really bad and terrible because it's good that she finds such barbaric behavior terrible and awful.
Right.
Yeah.
It says something good about her, not something bad about her.
And I can't wait for this investigation to see where he got his pirated copy. I mean, it's probably all over the country.
It's like, as,
ooh, little thief.
As Jack Candy said, when it rains, I think a cute thing to say to a kid is, that's God crying. And if he asks you why, I think another cute thing is to say, it's probably because of something you did.
Basically.
All right. So, that's Christianity in the media.
You know, one thing we haven't heard is whether or not that woman who had the heart attack, you know, gets to go to heaven and get 72 solo sex guys or something. There has to be some kind of merit to dying while you're watching this.
Yeah, there's got to be some joke of her at the pearly gates. You know what I mean? Okay, what happened to you? Well, Jesus killed me.
I've got to go back. I've got to go back. Why? I have to see what happens next.
Yeah, how does it end?
meanwhile, in better media news, atheist author Philip Pullman this week received his CBE. What did you say you thought that was?
The BE is British Empire. I think the C is Companion, but I'm not British, certain.
That's a knighthood kind of thing.
Yeah.
From the Queen of England, and heard the Archbishop of Canterbury hail his work as a near miraculous triumph. This is an atheist author now.
Yeah, you gotta wonder if the guy
who wrote
it.
A book.
I gotta wonder if the Archbishop read it.
We're talking about the trilogy of books called in the U.S. The Golden Compass trilogy. In Britain, it's called His Dark Materials.
Dark Materials.
It's a trilogy of books that's basically the story of the overthrow of the Judeo-Christian God and his army by the inhabitants of the universe, who then set up a republic to govern the universe in his place. And I better not tell you any more details than that. I strongly recommend everybody go out there and get one.
I know which side I'd be on.
Is it in paperbound?
Yes.
Excellent.
But while the children's author is being saluted from the highest echelons of the Anglican Church, to some he remains a figure of suspicion and controversy. The success of his Dark Materials trilogy has propelled Philip Pullman onto the very highest platform of lucrative literature. Viewers of the BBC's Big Read recently voted his work the third most popular ever, just after J.R.R. Tolkien's and Jane Austen's.
Wow.
And with his ability to create whole new worlds, he has been called Tolkien's natural heir. Pullman's grand tale of parallel universes, shape-shifting creatures, and courageous endeavor has been adapted into a national theater production of equally epic proportions. Like J.K. Rowling, Pullman has discovered that creating magic for the little people, by which I think this article means children, and not evil dwarves.
Not evil dwarves.
Leprechauns.
Can reap big rewards for his bank balance. The trilogy, Northern Lights, The Subtle Knife, and The Amber Spyglass, has won numerous awards and been translated into more than 30 languages. Like Rowling, Pullman has found the success of his book lies in their appeal to a more mature readership. He doesn't hesitate to embrace expansive and disturbing themes in a universe thrown into disarray, the demise of an ultimate authority, and the establishment of a republic of heaven. He makes apparent his distaste for organized religion, explaining that, quote, wherever you see priesthoods and power, you see tyranny and repression. It's almost a universal law. But these very adult ideas have created for Pullman a literary hot potato. The Archbishop of Canterbury, Dr. Rowan Williams, accepts intelligent criticism of the church, and this week called for his Dark Materials to form part of all pupils' religious education.
Damn.
Wow.
Now, there was another article about that specific thing where it's made more clear that what this archbishop wants is for those books to be included in the classes so that what the children are taught is why those books are wrong.
Right.
How they mistreat the church. So let's not
Right.
Misinterpret that. On the other hand, many traditional Christians, both in the UK and in the powerful Bible Belt of the US, have tagged Pullman a heretic and a threat to world order.
God.
The Catholic Herald
just world, a fatwa.
This would be the New World Order, of course.
A fatwa?
Yeah, sure. Why not?
The Catholic Herald has called his work blasphemy and fit for the bonfire.
Oh, well, I guess I'm too late.
The auto de fe. Hurrah.
Wow.
But,
damn.
You know, it's great at least to see that if there's going to be this huge media hit with a movie from the Bible, there are equally big media hits that have that take different themes than that.
Okay, are you at all familiar with Anatole France?
Uh-uh.
He wrote a story called The Revolt of the Angels, which I absolutely adore.
Yeah.
It's set in the 1920s, 1910s Paris. You got a nihilistic young man, complete libertine, and his guardian angel finally gets fed up with him and comes down to sort of set him straight. And right then, the young man's father comes out, so he has to race down to intercept his dad, and while he's gone, the angel reads his entire philosophy library, converts to nihilism, and suddenly the young man is chasing the angel around because he doesn't want to be damned for corrupting his own angel. And the angel's job is to find Satan, who's somewhere in Paris. And it turns out there's an entire angel underground, and they're all gathering at a sidewalk cafe, and they finally find him there at the end.
Cool.
Oh, and of course, he has his first taste of a woman. One of the young men's girlfriends was actually left with him.
Well.
It's a very excellent take on it.
Cool. That's cool.
That's neat.
Another thing that's coming out real soon is a little movie called Hellboy.
Yep, the world's greatest paranormal investigator.
Hellboy is based on a comic book of the same name. The premise is that back in the 1940s, the Nazis tried to destroy the world by summoning up this demon from the pits of hell, but when they get him, he's this little kid. And so the Nazis are defeated, and the little kid demon falls into the hands of the paranormal investigators,
right.
And they raise him, and he becomes the world's greatest, detective or monster hunter. But as the director of the film says in an interview, his style of investigating the paranormal is he opens a door, and if there's a monster there, he beats the crap out of it.
Yes.
I think it's fascinating.
He's a man of few words.
I think it's fascinating that that it's possible in our culture now to have a hero that's a demon.
Right. It has a pointy tail and
horns.
Bit, and
he files his horns down.
And he's red.
Kind of neat.
Right.
Yeah. Played by Ron Perlman.
Mm-hmm.
Previews look great. Guillermo del Toro is the director. And I'm really looking forward to this.
Should be cool.
I think part of the thing is
my favorite artist.
In religion, they take stuff like demons, right? Demons are iconic, right? They stand for evil. There's no deeper thinking about, what's demon society like?
What's their motive?
What do they eat, right? What do they eat? How do they raise their families? I mean, none of that ever comes up.
Right.
But if there really was this other race that, lived in this place called hell, right, they'd be a race. I mean, they'd have to get along. They'd have to have their own rules. They'd have to function according to physical laws. They'd be a
different
kind of entity.
Isn't there something in the Bible about giants mating with the daughters of men back in Eden? Isn't that like where the demons started or something?
Yeah. Oh, I don't know that that's where demons... I thought the demons were like... Or the original ones were other rebel angels that followed Lucifer down to hell. I think that's the myth.
Then I guess that would mean demon society is just like angel society.
Which, by the way, did we talk about To Reign in Hell here on the show, or was that before the show?
That was before the show.
Why don't you talk about that book just briefly, because that fits into the same kind of...
Oh, yeah, I got tons of books like that. Yeah, good old Stephen Bruce, that's B-R-U-S-T. You can't beat him. Absolutely the finest fantasy writer writing these days.
I agree.
And he has a book called To Reign in Hell.
Not quite.
You should have stopped while you were ahead.
Very close. Very, very close.
Nobody has a book called Terrain in Hell in which there are seven immortals. There's Yahweh, let's see if I get the order right, Yahweh, Satan, then you have Lucifer, Lilith. Oh, no, she's one of the seconds. Anyhow.
Don't worry about that.
I'm not. But the thing of it is the important thing with that is Yahweh comes into existence like one split teeny weeny second before the others. And one of the angels sort of builds on that to feed his ego and make him think that he's to take over heaven. Whereas you've got Satan who realizes that heaven is actually constantly under assault by chaos. And Satan realizes that people need to work together as a team, and you cannot legitimately force anybody to work to save heaven. Whereas Yahweh, under the influence of this other angel, thinks that it is morally okay to force people to come to and do things they don't want to do and risk their lives in order to save heaven. And he just talks about how what actually caused the angels to fall, how they ended up in heaven and hell, the divisions. It's a really wonderful story.
Yeah, is it Lucifer or Satan? One of those guys. He's the hero of the book.
Satan's number one. Lucifer's one of his friends.
Right. Another, cool. You know, same kind of take. It's like, okay, fine, let's take this premise seriously, right? And follow the implications where they lead. And generally, the implications do not lead toward, well, demons are just these ghostly, invisible, implacable, evil forces that have no interests or concerns or drives of their own. They're just there to hurt people and be and make things bad.
Right.
Right? I mean, that makes no kind of sense and no kind of story.
Yeah, it's more illogical than almost anything in their entire mythology. Other books along that line, of course, there's Good Omens, which they're making into a movie, by the way.
Oh, cool. I haven't read that one.
Oh, you haven't? Neil Gaiman and Terry Pratchett. Both of whom I think are terrible writers by themselves, but my golly, they're a good team. Especially Pratchett, he bites. But Good Omens is an excellent story about an angel and a demon who are trying to find the Antichrist.
You know, you're not going to score any points on this show by attacking people that I like or yelling at me for only rating Bruce the second best fantasy author.
That was not a yelling.
So,
the Gaiman's comic book is very good.
Why don't we back off? I don't actually like Neil Gaiman at all. But I like Pratchett.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Have you read any of his Sandman comics? That's another complete take.
Yeah. And don't much care for him.
Oh, really? Did you ever see the one where Lucifer decides to shut down hell?
Yeah.
It's his way of punishing him. He shuts down hell, gives the key to Sandman, and takes off and lets him deal with all the angels who want the key away. And all the gods from every mythology descend on him to try to get the key back because they all want to control hell. It was just a very good punishment.
That's fine. I don't like the writer.
Okay.
But anyway... going somewhere with this.
Where are you?
Another book along similar lines is called Lord of Light by Roger Zelazny.
Oh, yeah.
It's actually a science fiction story. The premise is there's a colony ship that has a small crew that's flying it to their destination planet, and then a huge number of colonists in cold sleep. And when the ship arrives, the crew decide, well, why not don't we take advantage of our position as the guys who control all the technology and make ourselves gods? So they drop off all the colonists without the benefit of any technology at all and leave them to fend for themselves. And then they fly around in their spaceships through the sky with their powered armor and stuff and lord it over the humans and run them like gods run a society. The book is about the one guy from the crew who decides this is wrong and works to fight against them. Now, all the crew take on personas from Hindu mythology. So you have Vishnu and
Shiva
and all those guys. But this guy patterns himself after the Buddha and organizes a resistance. It's also a really keen book.
Mm-hmm.
So, that's enough for it. Media. How much time we got left, Russell?
15 minutes.
15 minutes. Wow. Would you like to do a story?
Yeah.
Sure. What kind of
one
should do?
Whatever your favorite one is. I think we've wrapped up that entire topic, so you can go anywhere now. What do you want to talk about?
Well, how about some places where religion pops up into actual legislation?
Sure.
Okay. In Texas and in so many states, of course, we've just had our various primaries. And it's very worthwhile to go through and see what some of the winners have supported in the bills or what they've authored. For instance, we have a guy here in Texas, has supported a bill which points out about how it's the policy and purpose of the state of Texas to prevent deception of the public resulting from conferring and use of fraudulent or substandard college and university degrees. This is the guarantee that if you say you've got a bachelor's, then everybody knows that you've met certain requirements, that you've passed certain deals, that you're a certain level of intelligence. However, this particular bill says explicitly it's the policy and purpose of the state and the board to not regulate religious institutions. So if you go to a college or a university that is explicitly religious, they even define exactly what makes it religious, They have to be various exemptions, things that they have to meet. You could get a BA from there, and it could have absolutely nothing to do with a BA from any other university or college in the country. And people will not know that you've basically got an eighth grade education.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And this, well, you know, Kent Hovind, the creationist guy, always waves around his PhD that he got from a mail order university, and mm-hmm. you can find his PhD thesis online, and it's like pathetic. I mean, you know, there's spelling errors all over the place. And, you know, it's like 200 pages, but it's, you know, the typical college student, huge font, the double-spaced, small margin.
Is this the one where he famously equates the Flintstones to reality, saying that...
No, that's Carl Baugh.
Baugh on The Daily Show.
Oh, God.
Hadn't heard that one, huh?
But boy, creation.
I've heard
so
it,
funny.
Yes. Now I've been reminded.
Yeah, in fact, and wasn't it Al Franken?
Yes, I find this very plausible.
And wasn't it Al Franken and his lying liars who pointed out that college where he went to, he wanted to pull that gag, and they said that they didn't want to become accredited because then they'd have to fulfill state rules?
I don't remember
Al Franken doing that.
Okay, then that must have been another interview, the person who actually interviewed them. But yes, they went to one of these colleges. In fact, it may have been one of Oral Roberts, and asked them why they weren't accredited. Well, because then they just have all sorts of, you know, intellectual things they have to do.
Yeah, it would be hard.
That'd be so
They're
tough.
Probably willing to dilute any authority except theirs. Yeah.
Talking about Al Franken. The Liberal Radio Network is coming like any time now. I think it's debuting.
Are they going to hire Howard Stern?
No, I don't think so.
He needs work.
What?
You didn't hear about this?
No.
He got canned.
Howard Stern started talking out against George Bush.
Yes.
2 days later, he was fired.
Wow. I don't really like Howard Stern that much, but... That sucks.
Yeah, Claire Channel attributed it to their cleaning up of the airways decency thing.
Sieg Heil.
I think anybody who's listened to this show enough is going to realize that I actually kind of do like Howard Stern.
Okay.
And some of the stuff that he has been writing about the way that that all this happened and, you know, who controls the corporation that fired him and so on is very interesting.
Oh,
he's not a dumb guy.
I know he's not a dumb guy.
He just likes to look at titties.
Well, no, I don't. Doesn't. I have no problem with that.
Present company accepted. I don't want to make any assumptions. I'm just saying. So,
hey, what about the hot dogs?
Howard Stern out of... What?
Wait, what?
I think wrestling is the hot dog thing.
Oh.
Hot dog story? We have time for the hot dog story.
I would rather give a brief mention of the gay marriage thing.
Okay, do that.
March 11th, this is 2 days ago.
Uh-huh.
The California Supreme Court on Thursday, or you remember we talked about this last month during our Valentine's show.
Yes.
San Francisco officials were starting to hand out same-sex marriage license. The California Supreme Court on Thursday ordered city officials here to stop issuing marriage license to same-sex couples, bringing at least a temporary end to a month-long experiment that had thrust San Francisco to the forefront of a national debate on gay marriage. Effective immediately, we are stopping the issuance and recordation of same-sex marriage license, the city's assessor recorder, Mabel S. Teng, announced at a news conference after receiving word of the court's unanimous decision. The court did not rule on the legality of the marriages, nor did it address the constitutional issues raised by the city officials in defense of them. It also left open the possibility that the city could issue the licenses again after further review of two lawsuits on the matter. So, you know, only semi-bad news. There is kind of a sad ending to this article, however. Patricia Egan, 46, a real estate agent, and Megan Wharton, 29, a lawyer, were among the first would-be newlyweds who were turned away from the county clerk's office. The two women had flown to San Francisco in the morning from Phoenix for a 2:30 p.m. appointment. They had filled out the proper paperwork for the license, but when they approached the counter for their appointment, they learned they were 2 minutes too late.
Ugh.
I thought they were kidding, Ms. Wharton said. I didn't think it was possible, and certainly it wasn't possible to happen to me. I started crying. I'm devastated. That's a bummer.
It kind of makes me wonder. I mean, it raises the issue. What happens to people who have legitimately gotten gay marriages in other states or other countries if George Bush or if the Republicans in Congress succeed in passing this travesty of a constitutional amendment outlawing gay marriages outright? I mean, you know, these people have been married. Do they suddenly stop being married?
Well, in the case of foreign countries, I think we actually have treaties that say explicitly, similar to the full faith and credit clause in the Constitution, that we recognize legal contracts between your citizens and you, so when they come here as your citizens, then we recognize their status. Because I seem to remember that's why there was a big furor when the Netherlands started granting it, because, oh my God, they're going to come over here and we have to treat them as married people.
Hmm.
And, of course, in the states here, because of the Constitution, if one state legally recognizes a same-sex marriage, every state has to recognize that couple. They don't have to grant marriage in their own state, but they have to acknowledge your husband and husband.
Right. Hmm. Interesting. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I don't know, Russell. That's something the Supreme Court will have to...
And they're so mind-boggling. These people rail on and on about how the only way you're going to have a stable society is if everybody's happily married and settled in a nice family unit. And then they say gays are just so pathetic because they're constantly promiscuous and having sex everywhere and they're not settled down. So then they want to settle down.
Oh, and one more thing about gay marriage.
Yeah?
Roy Moore had a comment about it.
Oh, boy.
The most ironic comment in the world, perhaps.
Uh-huh.
He said there's no way that an amendment would work because in Moore's mind, the real problem is renegade courts.
What? Speaking of Roy Moore, elsewhere in Roy Moore, idiot of Alabama news, there was a challenge in the Alabama courts claiming that the empty space created when they moved his monument out of the front room of the courthouse, that empty space constitutes a monument to atheism.
Go us.
And therefore, the state is violating the separation of church and state.
Hmm.
Wow. Let's twist the facts.
Yeah.
They said it was thrown out, right?
Roy, look out, Roy. There's an empty space behind you. Look, over there in the street, there's an empty space.
Yeah, just atheists are everywhere.
You know, if empty space is a monument to atheism, then the entire universe is pretty much a monument to atheism.
Not to mention Roy Moore's head.
There's a tiny, tiny, tiny percentage of the universe that has matter in it.
Good. Well, you did say it was thrown out, though, right? I mean, they didn't even hear it?
And it wasn't even empty. It was full of oxygen. I guess mostly nitrogen. Some oxygen.
Yes.
You know, and dust and stuff. Huh?
Didn't you say it had been thrown out, that they refused to even hear that
lawsuit? Yeah, they threw it out.
Yay.
Well, duh.
Darn activist judges. They're never activists in the way you need them, huh?
But what an amazing thing to try to argue. Dennis, do you have anything you'd like to contribute?
Well, in our remaining 3 minutes?
Not a news story, or just...
Whatever you think you can do in 3 minutes.
I've got a new question.
A new question
that I'd like to ask.
All right.
My old question was, you know, if you could go back in time and successfully rescue Jesus from the crucifixion, would you do it?
And this is a question you ask of Christians on the Alt Atheism News Group whenever you get the chance.
To see what their answers is, to see, you know, absolutely.
Has anybody said yes yet, ever?
Only if they have a very bizarre and twisted version of Christianity.
What did Duke say? What did Duke say?
He was the one that had a bizarre, twisted version of Christianity.
He said he would go back?
When you can get a straight answer out of him, yeah.
Right.
But the new question is, have you judged God?
Ah.
Because they say, no, we won't. And if you don't judge, you know, they say, who am I to judge God? I say, well, you're the person worshiping him.
Right.
If you don't judge it as worthy of your worship, then you're saying you don't care whether it's worthy of your worship. You don't care whether it's good, whether it's evil, whether it's even a god. You don't care. And that's completely irresponsible. You have to judge it.
So have you gotten any responses on this yet?
I haven't gotten any straight answers. Nobody's directly responded to it. They can't.
As far as I can tell. You know, that came up in that email exchange that I was having recently with an old acquaintance of mine from Michigan, who, when I was, you know, just a struggling game designer, and he was a local kid in the gaming group that met once a week, I personally saw him descended upon by fundamentalists and sucked into their religion. Well, now he is a seminary student and emailed me out of the blue saying, I have to submit this paper for my apologetics class. Would you mind debating with me, you know, and that went round and round a little bit, and I can't really get into details now, but that question came up, and that's the ultimate excuse for all Christians as well. It's not me judging it, right? Well, you know, you judge the guy that set the rules, you know. You're telling me that you're not the guy sending me to hell, but you are the guy worshiping the entity that you believe is going to send me to hell,
right.
And you're cool with that. All right, well, that was a rollicking show. Thanks, everybody, for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you, Russell, for your diligent producing chores again.
No problem.
We will be back in 2 weeks, I semi-promise, and we will leave you once again with Battle Without Honor or Humanity by Tomoyasu Hotai from Kill Bill Volume 1 soundtrack. See you later.